You know, the number one factor that causes staff stress in the health service, and it's chronic stress, is chronic work overload. And it's become like the pattern in the wallpaper that we no longer see. Yet it's the number one reason for staff quitting. It's the number one factor in errors that harm patient safety. It's the key inhibitor of quality improvement and new and improved ways of doing things. And the proliferation of targets and KPIs from national organisations like NHS England and NHS Improvement, albeit with the best of intentions, I think is a key factor in creating these cultures of chronic excessive workload, which are doing so much damage in public sector organisations.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So, really delighted to welcome along today Michael West, CBE, who joined the King's Fund as a senior fellow in 2013. He's Professor of Work and Organisational Psychology at Lancaster University, Visiting Professor at University College Dublin and Emeritus Professor at Aston University. He's authored, edited and co-edited 20 books and has published more than 200 articles on teamwork, leadership and culture, particularly in healthcare. He's a Fellow of the British Psychological Society, the American Psychological Association, the APA Society for Industrial and Organisational Psychology, the Academy of Social Sciences, the International Association of Applied Psychologists and the British Academy of Management. Michael has extensive experience of working to improve staff experience and care quality. He assisted the development of the National Frameworks on Improvement and Leadership Development in England and Northern Ireland and is currently supporting Health Education and Improvement Wales to develop the National Health and Care Leadership Strategy in Wales. He co-chaired the two-year inquiry into the mental health and well-being of nurses and midwives across the UK, which was published in 2020, and his latest book is Compassionate Leadership, which he kindly gave us the opportunity to read prior to the interview. And I'm really delighted that we managed to have the conversation with Michael today, because we'd invited him to give a keynote speech at the 20-year anniversary conference for the FENS unit, which unfortunately wasn't able to happen last year due to COVID. So really great to get the chance to speak with you today, Michael. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Naomi. Thank you.
Hello, Michael. It's very nice to meet with you, and thanks very much for letting us see the parts of the book that you've just produced. I've managed to read most of those and found them extremely interesting and relevant to the kind of work which Naomi and I have been doing through this podcast. So thanks a lot for that. Michael,
well, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure, David. And the book was actually published yesterday.
Fantastic.
It's called Compassionate Leadership, Sustaining Wisdom, Humanity and Presence in Health and Social Care. But I think it's got wider applicability, of course, to many organisations.
Absolutely. So, Michael, you've had a long and illustrious career. Can you tell us something about the path that you've taken and how you've ended up so immersed in the culture of the NHS?
Well, I think my mother would say I've had an illustrious career. I feel I've had just a really privileged career. And I think what I've always done is to pursue what my heart told me to pursue rather than to follow a predefined career path. And I think we often make sense of careers in retrospect as being a journey with, you know, planned way stations, but I don't think it happened like that. I mean, getting involved in researching in the NHS was in one sense serendipitous, because I was in a research team looking at job change and how that affects people's development. And we wanted to look at people who were working in really restricted contexts and compare them with people who were working in quite open, free contexts. And we looked, this is back in the 1980s, at student nurses, highly intelligent, motivated young people, but placed in circumstances where they had no discretion or autonomy. And we compared them with community nurses, health visitors, in fact, who, you know, similarly nursing professionals, but in a context where back in those days they had much greater freedom and autonomy in how they did their work. And that led to looking at the contexts that health visitors were working in, primary healthcare teams, and that led into the exploration of team working and then to the culture of organizations. And although I worked in other sectors, I think certainly the inspiration and the joy I felt in working with professionals who were just extraordinary people across the NHS meant that I took more and more interest in how we would create the conditions in healthcare organisations where high quality, compassionate care could be delivered, and particularly alongside that, or integral to that, is how we create the conditions where we provide high quality and continually improving and compassionate support for staff.
Brilliant, thank you very much. I love the way that you refer to yourself as having had a privileged career, which is very much how I see myself. Mm. Actually, I think those of us who've worked in this field have been extremely fortunate. So your latest work is focused very firmly upon compassion. Now, I have to admit that compassion is a word that I have a bit of difficulty with. I don't know whether you're familiar. Of course, I come from a psychoanalytic background, so we tend to talk less about compassion and more about destructiveness. And I don't know whether you're familiar with Isabel Menzies' Lives early paper, 1960, I think it was, Social Systems, the Defence Against Anxiety, where she focuses on a very similar area to you in many ways. And she identifies key issues of kind of internal aggression and how that develops into anxiety, which leads to many of the problems in team functioning and in work functioning within those health service settings. So I wonder if you could explain to us how you define using the term compassion and how it relates to that term or that usage of ideas from Isabel Menzies' Lives.
So very simply, if I'm to be compassionate towards somebody in pain or distress or fear, then I think what that means is I have to do four things. I have to attend, understand, empathize, and help. And attending has two meanings. I think it means being present, attending as I attend an event, means being present with the other. And I think it's also, the second meaning is about giving my awareness or attention to that person. And I think Nancy Klein's lovely phrase, listening with fascination, sums up that notion. And second, I have to understand the causes of their distress. And that ideally is not done by my imposing my understanding, but through a dialogue. So we achieve a shared, deeper, more comprehensive understanding together. And third is I have to have an empathic response, a feeling response, so that I, to some extent, without being overwhelmed by it, mirror their fear or pain or anger, distress. And that gives me the motivation for the fourth element of compassion, which is helping or serving the other person. And we know quite a lot from, for example, neuroscience studies about the difference between empathy and compassion. Empathy is associated with the activation of pain centers in the brain, not surprisingly, because we're mirroring the other's pain. Whereas when we ask people to be compassionate, that's associated with the activation of reward centers, because most of us, 99% of us, are hardwired to be altruistic, compassionate, caring by evolution. That's what enabled us to form social groups, to work in teams, to achieve a sense of connection and a sense of belonging, to blur the boundaries between self and other. Paul Gilbert talks about the three emotion regulation systems that humans have. The emotional regulation system of responding to threat with aggression that you referred to, the emotion regulation system of goal orientation, of seeking to acquire resources, and the goal orientation system of nurturing or compassion, if you like. And his argument and others' argument is that many of the kind of social structures we formed have focused an enormous amount on things like competition and profitability, in a way emphasizing the threat and resource acquisition or goal orientation systems, and we've neglected the nurturing compassion element. And you know, I think compassion is, because it's a system, well, because compassion is something we're hardwired to do, I think what we've seen over recent decades is greater alienation, less connection between people. And what we've seen in the course of the pandemic is, as we see in all disasters, you know, the work of Rebecca Solnit, A Paradise Built in Hell, shows how in disasters there's this upwelling of this natural human reaction of compassion. And that's what we've seen during the last 16, 17 months, of people taking care of each other, of communities taking care of each other. And I think it's been a timely reminder that we need to right the imbalance in our emotional regulation systems to create more of a sense of connection with each other, with our ecosystems, with our planet indeed. So it's a very long answer to an apparently simple question.
That's a great answer. Thanks very much indeed. So your book is primarily focused on the NHS, but it strikes me there's a lot that's relevant to other organisations, and we think most often of the prison service. Are there any changes you'd make to the concept if you were applying it to other settings such as the prison service?
No, I don't think so. I think what when we're talking about compassion, when we're talking about belonging, when we're talking about compassion partly being about meeting core human needs, the needs for autonomy and control and belonging and a sense of contribution or competence, that whatever organization we're talking about, those underlying human characteristics are the same. I mean, there are obviously service variations. And what organizations are, of whatever kind, whether it's prisons or hospitals or retail organizations, they are simply another form of human community. And when we talk about compassion and belonging and connection and alienation and rejection and exclusion and discrimination, you know, we're talking about very basic human orientations and needs. So I think, you know, as I've implied already, there's a need for our society as a whole to create the conditions in which there's a greater sense of connection and belonging, where people feel, you know, that they have voice and influence, and where they also find meaning in their lives through the contribution they're able to make.
I think you have a tremendous way of describing those aspects of teams and team functioning, actually, Michael. A little passage I pulled out of your chapters went something like, a team climate of psychological safety with a shared vision, values and goals, support for reflection, learning and innovation. I thought that kind of more or less summed it up, really. Beautiful little description of a healthy team. I have to say, I've worked in places where it felt far from psychologically safe. And of course, the major issue then often is, how can one change that kind of situation? What would you think, Michael? How can you change these toxic places?
Well, of course, we all have it, you know, I think we have it within our own control to behave compassionately, to be present with others, to listen with fascination, to empathize and to help. And that's the most powerful way, I think, that we can bring about change. But we can also, you know, in toxic environments, my experience in working with teams in many different settings over the years, some of that toxicity often comes from sort of failures not to create the right conditions. So teams without clear shared vision or objectives, or you know, often teams that just simply don't take the time to meet regularly, so misunderstandings and conflicts arise, or where roles aren't clear. And so there are interventions that can rapidly bring about those changes. There are sometimes people who exhibit difficult behaviours, and very often what I've seen is, people attribute those difficult behaviours to the personality of the person rather than to the situation they find themselves in. And very often those people haven't been given feedback about their behaviour, and simply the generous act of giving honest, supportive feedback can bring about change. I've been working for the last few years in the NHS focused on the broader question implied by what you say, which is how do we transform the culture of whole organisations, maybe of 10,000, 12,000, 14,000 people. And we've identified what the key cultural elements are in high-performing organisations, and then focused on how we create the leadership at every level, informal and formal leadership, where the behaviours that will nurture those cultural elements are developed. And that's a programme that's been now being implemented in about 80 NHS trusts in England, as well as in other places, with really positive outcomes in terms of patient care and staff experience. And we've lots of examples of organisations where transformational changes are being brought about, whether it's, you know, through that programme, implemented, for example, in Royal Bournemouth and Christchurch Hospital. We've got other examples like Merseycare, where they wanted to move from a blame culture to a restorative culture, and they've, in a very short space of time, reduced disciplinaries by over 70% and suspensions by over 80% in the context of creating a learning, psychologically safe culture. And in all my work in health and social care services, I think, you know, I've been really inspired by seeing how much change can be brought about relatively quickly in teams, but also whole organisations in terms of the culture. And I think that's enormously empowering, because people can often develop a kind of learned helplessness in the experience of working in toxic organisations. So, yeah, I feel very positive we can bring about those kind of changes. And of course, my book covers quite a lot of that material, providing practical resources and websites and all the rest of it to help with that.
I think it's really inspiring to hear you. You can hear the compassion in you, actually, when you think about some of the problems that that people face within the NHS. So obviously, there's been a lot of publicity about the toxic cultures, the bullying, and what have you, within trusts. But you can really hear your efforts to understand that, and also I think a really strong theme in your book is about the fact that people don't join the NHS to be bullies or to be abusive or neglectful, but that, you know, fundamentally people are joining the NHS usually because they're driven to be caring and compassionate. So how do we then get the best out of people? But I also wanted to make reference to your earlier book on teams, because certainly I think, you know, using some brilliant work on the concept of a transdisciplinary team, which you propose, where I don't think teams think about enough. So too often, I think some of the conflicts that arise within the NHS of people competing with different approaches or different ideas about what the aims and objectives are for a team, when actually having those shared aims and objectives for a team where each person in the team has their own unique contribution to make is so essential and takes away some of the threat that people experience when they're sat in a team alongside different professionals where they feel there's some competition for resources. So I would really encourage anybody listening to check out Michael's book on teams, actually.
Yeah, I thank you, Naomi. And you know, what's fascinating about diverse teams and multi-professional transdisciplinary teams is, you know, we know that when you create new teams and people come from very different backgrounds, that you get more conflict, and that's both inevitable and really a good thing. It's inevitable because you have different perspectives, different experiences, different views, different orientations, and it's a good thing because as we work through and develop our understanding of these different perspectives, we both create the conditions for creativity and innovation, because we're, you know, digesting different perspectives. But we also create a really strong psychological safety, because by working through conflict, as you know, in families or in teams, by working through it and coming to positive creative outcomes, you establish a sense of safety that it's safe enough to disagree and to work through that. In fact, the innovation, you know, if you're innovating, then there's going to be conflict. And I always think that probably the best barometer of a team's health is the level of innovation in a team. And the most effective teams are able to have conflicts about tasks and how to do things and emerge from those conflicts with ideas for new and improved ways of doing things, but a stronger sense of belonging and safety with each other. And that's what we should be aiming for in our organisations, I think.
I think that's a really good point. But I don't know about you, David. I don't know what your experience is, but I think quite often forensic services are very frightened of conflict. And so there can be an effort to try and quash that out rather than actually make use of it in a productive, progressive way. Is that your experience, David?
Well, I find that people are terrified of conflict because it seems to reflect fighting rather than a creative process, and so that tends to lead to a dynamic being rather stuck and rigid very often. Is that the kind of thing you meant?
Yeah, I think that's been my experience. That's what I was thinking about. I think it makes people frightened to engage with conflicts. It's really good to hear you saying how important that is, Michael.
And I think it's quite important to distinguish between different types of conflict. So interpersonal conflict, chronic interpersonal, I don't mean, you know, we fall out briefly, you know, there's a bit of irritation and somebody, you know, says something in the heat of a moment. And that happens in families and groups and teams and organisations and is part of the stuff of social life. But it's chronic interpersonal conflict, which is so damaging in teams and organisations, and profoundly damaging to team performance. And so there's something about really being really clear that we will not simply accept people having a chronic interpersonal conflict and that being having an effect within our teams and organisations, especially in organisations that are human-centred, as it were. And then there's task conflicts about, you know, what should we be doing, and the process conflicts about how we should be doing them. And those are healthy differences of opinion or debates, and we need to work through those. The danger is that sometimes, because people maybe go at them too vigorously, they can spill over into interpersonal conflict and become sustained interpersonal conflict. So there's a skill, I think, in managing conflict in organisations. I recommend Amy Gallo's book, Dealing with Conflict. It's a Harvard Business Review book. Amy Gallo is Gallo. But it's a lovely book about leaning into conflict and dealing with it compassionately, transparently, ethically and courageously. And I just think every professional working in human service organisations, the prison service, health and care services, should have a really good understanding, a shared understanding of how to deal with conflict in a positive, healthy way.
I think it's really helpful to have that distinction made, because I know certainly in the team that I've most recently worked in for a very long time, we would have quite a lot of task conflict. And I think new people would come and they would hear us having, we've worked together for like over 20 years, some of us, so we would have quite heated discussions, but we were able to have them because we were fond of each other and there's a respect for each other. But I think new people would come in and hear, wow, that's a strong debate, and they would get a bit fearful of that and maybe confuse it for interpersonal conflict rather than task conflict. And I think with hindsight, I think we could be better at spelling out to new people what was happening so that people were aware and learned that conflict is good in work if it's about resolving a task and making sure that you get the best outcome.
Yeah, So managing their expectations and maybe the team, as you say, recognizing that their interactions might be misinterpreted.
Yeah.
I think insecurity about personal role, professional role can feed into these kind of conflicts, which very quickly can become highly, highly personal, unfortunately. And of course, it's difficult to, I mean, thinking of the prison service, it's difficult to sometimes resolve these conflicts when you've got a large organisation with a large group of people in different groups. So, for example, working in somewhere like the Fens or a therapeutic community, as I did at Gartree, then you're deliberately trying to set out and create a compassionate climate, a compassionate environment, and yet the staff, the prison officers and nurses sometimes get attacked and derided, abused as being care bears, of being fluffy bunnies. But that's not really the meaning of the word compassionate in your terms, is it, Michael?
No, I mean, I think that being, for example, being a compassionate leader in these contexts is not a soft cushions and scented candles approach to leadership. It requires a lot more courage, I think, and authenticity. It's certainly not about neglecting performance, because our compassion is ultimately for the communities we serve, the people in prison, the staff we lead, the wider community. And so our focus as compassionate leaders is very much on ensuring high quality performance. And it's not about taking some easy consensus way forward, because sometimes as compassionate leaders, in the interests of the communities that we serve, you know, the staff, the people in prison, the wider community, we have to make decisions that the people we lead may not want. And it's also, I think about, you know, compassionate leadership is about being effective as a leader. And that's about ensuring that there's clear direction in our teams and organizations, that there's alignment of efforts, and that we are creating commitment, a sense of trust and motivation amongst those that we lead. And it's about not just increasing our own power, but helping others to feel that they have leadership responsibility and rights, and that there's shared leadership in teams. We know the most effective teams are those where there's shared leadership. You may have a hierarchical leader, but that person's role is to ensure that they're utilizing everyone's knowledge and skills and experience. And it's about how, and I think, you know, this is critically important, is it's about compassionate leadership is about leading across boundaries, working with other teams, other departments, other organizations, other sectors as well, and always asking the question, how can we help you so that together we deliver for the communities we serve? And that's what we see amongst the most effective, compassionate leaders. And of course, you know, if leadership is not inclusive, then it's not compassionate.
Could you say a bit more about that, Michael, in terms of if it's not inclusive, it's not compassionate? What do you mean by this?
Well, if we take the... Let's just take the last 15 or 16 months. You know, what the pandemic did was to shine a light on what we... It shone a particularly harsh spotlight on what we already knew, that if you exclude people, discriminate against people, it has profound effects on health. We know that, you know, for example, children excluded from their friendship groups in the playground, it has an effect on inflammation of the central nervous system, on immune functioning. And we know that people discriminated against over their life courses, people from lower socioeconomic groups, people with disabilities, people from minority ethnic groups, people with variations in skin color from the majority. There's a biological weathering effect of discrimination that they experience over the lifespan. And the pandemic, you know, with its impact on its disproportionate impact on people with disabilities, on people from minority ethnic groups, simply shone a spotlight on what we already knew. So discrimination, inclusion, compassion, it's a moral issue, it's a health issue, but it's also actually, given what you were saying earlier, Naomi, it's a performance issue. We know that diverse teams and organizations, when they have a positive culture, are much more innovative and productive than, you know, more homogenous groups, if you like. I think everybody working in the public sector should have a working knowledge of the effects of discrimination on health. I think every leader should have a knowledge of the effects of diversity on performance, the positive effects of diversity on performance. I mean, we see it, whether it's in boards, executive teams, community mental health teams, primary care teams, breast cancer care teams, that diversity in teams is associated with better performance and innovation. So I think inclusion and compassion are like two sides of the same hand. You know, it's the same thing. It's about belonging. People, you know, compassion is about blurring the boundaries between self and other. It's about belonging. Inclusion is about creating a sense of belonging. And, you know, in human behavior, we know you're more likely to die from the effects of loneliness, if you like, exclusion, than you are from the effects of, say, smoking or obesity. And at a fundamental level, it means, or a practical level, it means everybody in my team should feel included by my leadership, equally included by my leadership, that I attend, understand, empathize, and help in relation to everybody in my team, and that they all feel included. And that has to be the organizational culture of the future, I believe. Does that answer the question, Naomi?
Yeah, it does. And I think it's hard to, you know, just thinking about that report about the snowy white peaks of the NHS, and, you know, I'd suggest that the prison service, again, might be on a par with that. And it's hard to feel that you belong or that you're valued if you don't see any people like you in those positions of leadership, you know, whether the likeness is visible or invisible. You know, if there isn't greater representation of people from racially minoritized groups, with disabilities, from working class backgrounds in some of these senior management positions, then it's hard to see that the leadership is perhaps open and inclusive, and that you could possibly belong there, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, when you you were talking about bullying in the NHS earlier, and one of the studies that we've done, I mean, we have an enormous amount of data on what it's like to work in the NHS, because a national staff survey was introduced in 2003. That's run annually ever since. We've got 18 years worth of data, and about 500,000 people now respond every year. So it's the most amazing data set. And one of the analyses we did was to look at leadership representativeness. And so where leaders are representative of those they lead, and the data, as you'll know, in the health service are quite shocking in terms of, if we take ethnicity, the number of chief executives and the number of board members from minority ethnic group backgrounds, or the number of medical directors. Let's just take medical directors as an example. 46% of doctors in the NHS are from a minority ethnic group background, but only 17% of medical directors come from such a background. I think there's only about 10 chief executives from a minority ethnic group background out of around, I can't remember, 220 or 240 organisations. So anyway, our research looked at the extent to which leaders were representative of those that they led in the NHS. And what we found was that where that representativeness was low, levels of, in relation to ethnicity, levels of bullying and harassment were higher, particularly in relation to those from minority ethnic group backgrounds. So bullying and harassment is often, I think, a symptom of these underlying cultural problems. So ensuring that kind of representativeness is for the very, you know, for the reasons that you cogently outline, enormously important, but also important for the other effects it has on culture that you know, we express such concern about, because you know, we can't afford to lose staff in the prison service, in the health service, because of the staff shortages that exist already. It's not just about hiring more staff. Well, it is about hiring more staff. It's not only about that. It's also about then creating the conditions where they're retained, and inclusive and compassionate leadership, I think, are core to that.
Thank you. And we recently interviewed David Boyle about his book Tick Box. I don't know if you're familiar with that. He writes about the effect of KPIs and tick box culture. And I wondered whether you thought the increasing emphasis on things like KPIs and tick box culture might undermine the ability for an organisation to be compassionate.
Organisations are just another form of human community. And I think if we start from that premise, it's a community of people working together. And their needs for belonging and autonomy and control and competence are fundamental to our ability to create a happy, healthy, productive community. The problem, and of course, it's really important to have a clear shared vision of what we're here for, what we're trying to achieve. And it's important to have 5 or 6 clear goals, strategic goals associated with that. We know in teams, it's really important to have a vision of what the team is there to achieve. That's not just a bunch of words. It's a beacon that guides our decision making, and that every team should have, you know, 4 or 5 really clear associated goals, because that ensures direction and alignment. 3 or 4, not 34. 5 or 6, not 56. And the problem with, so we need that kind of focus, and that's good performance management. But when we get a proliferation of targets, people feel oppressed. They feel out of control. They feel like their voices aren't heard. And very often those targets are set remotely. They're from somewhere higher up in the hierarchy. And they make no sense to those who are delivering key services, as it were, at the front line, or the face-to-face services. So the point about team goals is that those goals should be aligned around the vision that the team has worked out and shared. And they should be shared goals and objectives that are worked out by the team. The more we impose KPIs and proliferate targets, the more overwhelmed people feel. And if I can take the example of the health service, you know, the number one factor that causes staff stress in the health service, and it's chronic stress, is chronic work overload. And it's become like the pattern in the wallpaper that we no longer see. Yet it's the number one reason for staff quitting. It's the number one factor in errors that harm patient safety. It's the key inhibitor of quality improvement and new and improved ways of doing things. And the proliferation of targets and KPIs from national organisations like NHS England and NHS Improvement, albeit with the best of intentions, I think is a key factor in creating these cultures of chronic excessive workload, which are doing so much damage in public sector organisations. I think we've developed a kind of rational, mechanistic, intellectual, managerial approach to thinking about organisations. And it's deeply misguided, because it misses the point that these are human communities, and that's how they have to be conceived and supported.
So brilliantly put, Michael. Thank you. And what are some of the other factors that undermine an organisation's ability to be compassionate?
I think, you know, I've mentioned chronic work overload, and I think that is a key factor. I think there's a pathology in modern organisations of overwork. I mean, you know, you just think about what's happened this last 16 months. The proliferation of meetings over Zoom or Teams or whatever, And people then start to find themselves in meetings from 8:30 in the morning till 5:30 or 6 at night. I mean, we're human beings. We need to move. We need to have rest. We need to have breaks. We need to hug people from time to time, our loved ones. We need to go out and see the greenery outside. Those are the things which nourish us. So chronic work overload is, a shared pathology in many organisations. The other, I think another is cultures of fear and blame. You know, people are, I talk to people in the health service, you know, doctors with in their late 30s, early 40s, who describe feeling afraid, feeling told, you know, being told off for running down the corridors, feeling afraid they've got inadequate numbers of staff or inadequate equipment, and being told that, you know, that they could be blamed or pilloried when they make a mistake, or even worse, prosecuted for criminal gross criminal negligence and struck off. And those are the conditions that I think inhibit compassion too, because people, you know, turn in on themselves more as a consequence of working in those sorts of cultures. And it's about, you know, creating learning and just cultures, as I said. I think the other is that there's inadequate understanding of the evidence that tells us what makes for effective organisations. So people continue to run organisations with a mythical notion of what good leadership and management is about, often based on the notion of hierarchy and command and control. And yet we see from, you know, work, for example, if we take work in the private sector, Ben Schneider's work in the United States over many decades has shown that where leaders collectively in an organization behave with compassion, that's associated with staff satisfaction, better service for customers, customer loyalty, productivity and profitability. So there's a kind of value chain. And we see the same in the NHS, in the organizations with the highest levels of staff stress, where staff are not being looked after, where there are poor leadership behaviors. Subsequently, we see significantly worse care quality, worse financial performance, higher levels of staff turnover, lower levels of patient satisfaction, and higher levels of avoidable patient mortality, patient deaths. So there's, I think, the other factor is a lack of understanding about the clear evidence that compassion is so powerful as a leadership orientation and as a culture in terms of enabling us to achieve the very thing we want to achieve in our organisational outcomes.
Thank you. I think you've begun to hint at the answer towards the next question I was going to ask. Because when we began doing this podcast, Naomi and I decided that what we wanted to do, as well as having interesting conversations, we wanted to somehow have an impact. We wanted the conversations that we had with people to have some sort of influence. And of course, you are an influencer. You're someone who's in a position to exert influence. But generally speaking, how do we get leaders or boards of trusts, companies, how do we get them to give greater weighting to some of the factors, some of the criteria that you've been describing just now, rather than the more numbers-driven targets? How do we make an impact?
So what you said, I think, is absolutely right, David, that it is about, it's really important to provide the evidence. And I suppose what I've learned over the last, particularly I would say the last 20 years in my work in the NHS, is that I remember back in about 2002, 2003, we were looking at people management practices and strategies and quality improvement approaches in manufacturing, and then also in finance organizations, and then in the health sector. And we made the discovery that the best predictor of manufacturing company performance across the UK was how people were managed in the organizations. That was what predicted productivity and profitability. And then we found in the NHS that people management practices were by far the best predictor of avoidable patient deaths. And that's been subsequently replicated in other studies we've done and others have done, and we've gone on to show the link with care quality. And it simply confirms the evidence in many sectors about how people are managed is the key predictor of performance in organisations. So there's something about making sure that we present that evidence. But what I've learned is it's not good enough to present it once to key leaders. You have to go on presenting it again and again and again and again. And when you think everybody's got the message, you're just starting. And it's like, I kind of think of it as the image of like a drip of water on a rock. You know, the rock will eventually start to change its shape. But the other important, I think the other, you know, for me, the development of the, if you like, compassionate leadership movement in the NHS over the last 4 or 5 years has been, you know, been an astonishing demonstration of how a movement can grow and how change can happen. And I think the Black Lives Matter movement has had a huge impact in the, in a similar kind of way. So there is something about persistence and presenting the evidence persistently. But the other is, if we want to change an organisation or change a sector, that the most dangerous thing you can do is to try to do that by yourself. So, you know, if you, Naomi, or you, David, were to set out to say, well, I'm going to, you know, really, really put my head above the back parapet repeatedly, the evidence we have from work on minority influence and on innovation in organisations is that you're more likely to get chewed up and spat out than you are to be successful. And that what's effective in bringing about change is creating, having a group of people, a small group of people, ideally influential, who have a shared vision of the change that we want to bring about and who articulate 3 or 4 or 5 clear messages and who repeat and repeat and repeat those messages and work together as a social movement, rather like the Greens and the feminists who've been so profoundly influential in changing the way we think and behave in society. And as I say, Black Lives Matter movement as well. So, and your point about boards, I think, is really important. The first group I try to talk to in an organisation is the board, because, you know, if we can get the executive team or the board, and we never get all of them, but get most of them to support not only rhetorically, but practically as well, the change we want to bring about, then that makes the path much easier.
Brilliant. That's great.
Well, I was just thinking that how important do you think it is for compassion to be an explicit objective for an organisation to develop a compassionate ethos? And might that be harder in an institution like the criminal justice system, which wasn't set up to be compassionate and has to manage societal pressures to be a place of punishment?
Yeah, so, you know, culture is... you know, I think we think from the research, culture is a product of the founding values of an organisation. It's a product of how people are socialised when they join the organisation, what they experience when they come in. A bit like you were describing with the team earlier, you know, one of the things they're going to learn is that caring for each other enables us to have healthy debate. And you know, that's the way we transmit values. But the evidence we have from research on culture over the last 100 years in organisations is that the most important influence is probably the leadership at every level of a culture. Because what leaders pay attention to and talk about and monitor and reward and model in their own behaviour tells those around them what it is that they should value. So the question is then, how do we transform the culture? And I think having compassion and inclusion as core values is essential in any human community, any organisation. But it's not sufficient, of course, just to have a bunch of words on the website that say our values are inclusiveness and compassion when leaders aren't behaving that way. So the challenge is, how do we integrate those behaviours into the organisation so that compassion and inclusion are, if you like, written into the DNA of the organisation, that they're written into the genetic code. And so that requires, I think, that we select and we attract and we recruit and we develop and we sustain leaders with a focus on, for example, compassion and inclusion and justice and fairness and courage. And the work I've been doing with the NHS over the last 5 years in developing a culture and leadership program began because we knew what we needed to get in place in terms of the culture. It was the how we achieve that, and that's about developing, well, attracting and developing and leaders in the way I've described. So we've developed a culture and leadership program which has been implemented by over 80 trusts across the country with very positive outcomes. And what we've done is to make sure that compassion and inclusion are part of the interview process. They're emphasized in recruitment materials. They're the central part of appraisals. So the way we appraise people is first and foremost on those values. They're part of the way that staff assess their leaders, a fundamental part of that. This year, there's every possibility, every likelihood that the National Staff Survey in the NHS will have a measure of compassionate leadership in the staff survey, so that organisations will get feedback on the extent to which they're developing collective leadership cultures characterised by compassion. And so it's about ensuring that in every area, team working, learning and innovation, people management, direction of vision and values, managing goals and performance, that we're building in those values to those processes. So that every organisational process is, if you like, imbued with those values, rather than it being just a bunch of words on the wall or an optional add-on. And that's how we transform culture. Now, you know, it might sound like, poof, that's a big ask, but we're doing it. We've got, as I said, 80 organisations going through that process in the NHS and other organisations in other parts of the UK and in other countries as well. And I've seen so many inspiring examples of organisations and teams that have brought about change in a short period of time from building values into the DNA of how they work. So it's about having that comprehensive, determined approach and to sustain it over the long term. Sorry, Naomi, I interrupted you.
Well, no, you didn't. I thought you'd finished. I was just going to say, you can kind of see how that works for the NHS, but I suppose for the prison service, they have a different, you know, they have different pressures, and there's this pressure from the public for prisons to be places of punishment, which then sits alongside people who are perhaps wanting to, what's offered to be more compassionate, and just wondering really about how able those at the higher leadership of the prison service and probation service are able to make that kind of very tangible commitment to providing compassionate services, and whether that becomes difficult because of the public pressure.
So leadership is not about, leadership is not managing the inevitable. It's doing what we know to be the right thing. It's offering a vision. It's helping to articulate a vision. It's helping to align our scarce resources so that we are achieving the outcomes we want to achieve. And it's creating trust and commitment. And also, I would say leadership is not about finding solutions necessarily. Leadership is about bringing attention to the key issues we need to focus on. Part of the challenge, I think, in the NHS is we have to move away from a paternalistic system that doles out care to a supplicant population, or, if you like, responds to the demands of a community that says, give us more, give us more, give us more. You know, the underlying issue is a problem of preventative healthcare. It's a problem of how people and communities and families take care of their own health. It's a problem of alienation and exclusion in society. It's a problem of criminality. It's a problem of offending. It's a problem of education. It's a problem of inequalities. And so solving these problems in isolation is not possible. I think what we're seeing is now a recognition that we have to integrate the workings of all of the agencies and institutions that are involved in creating the conditions where people can live happy, fulfilling lives, where they feel safe and loved and they grow and develop and have a sense of wonder in life. And too many people live their lives in quite the opposite way, with really toxic consequences. And that means the criminal justice system, the education system, the voluntary sector, the healthcare system, local authorities, social care, all working together. And we're starting to see that in places like West Yorkshire and Harrogate, in the Wigan deal in Manchester, with the devolution in Manchester. And we're seeing it in smaller settings like the Bromley by Brough Primary Care Group in London, with its social prescribing and the community volunteers looking after people. And that's the direction we have to go in. I mean, the Montefiore system in the Bronx, a young woman turns up again in A&E for the third time in 3 months with a drug overdose. And the Montefiore system has started to address the underlying issues of, well, we've got to look at how this woman is being housed in unsanitary conditions without adequate water supply, no job, no support system. She has two young children that she's not able to take care of. We need to engage all of the agencies and social systems to address the underlying problem, or that person will likely end up either dead or in prison. And so I think that's the direction of travel. And it also means, I think, involving the community in the genuine co-ownership and co-design of services that we provide. At the moment, there is this, I think, separation of services and atomization of services, which is problematic. And I think also it means starting leaders at the top of, for example, the prison service, the criminal justice system, beginning to have grown-up conversation, and politicians beginning to have grown-up conversations with communities about how we address these problems. What's been striking this last 16 months is how the community has been so incredibly compassionate. And, as Rebecca Solnit's work shows in Paradise Built in Hell, the community takes responsibility. They've accepted the privations of the last 16 months in an extraordinary way. And yet we know that what elites expect is rioting, looting, savagery. And that's not what happens in disasters. What happens is the community is compassionate, and there is this upwelling and this taking responsibility. So it's a very long answer to your question, but I think I'd summarise it by saying leaders must understand what leadership is truly about, which is not pleasing the majority. That's not what leadership is. Leadership is also about recognizing that we have to integrate the way we work across all agencies involved in people's well-being. And we have to also make sure that we're creating compassionate cultures, but we're engaging the community in a grown-up, shared, adult-to-adult conversation about how we manage our society and in the long term. And that's going to be essential, because giving people a sense of connection and responsibility and control is important, not only in terms of how we manage threats like the pandemic, but also how we manage the much greater existential threats of loss of biodiversity and climate change. And that's fundamentally about seeing ourselves as being connected with everything around us. And that is about compassion and co-ownership and co-caring.
Thank you. And that's a lovely, uplifting answer, which brings us nicely onto our final question, which is, Michael, you've spent a lot of time researching and writing about some of the factors that make organisations difficult places to be in. How have you managed to sustain your own hope, optimism and compassion over your lengthy career?
I said at the beginning, I feel really privileged, but I've just been so privileged in the work I've been doing. And, you know, certainly I feel an enormous sense of privilege in working in health and care services and other public sector services. And I've just been, I mean, genuinely, Naomi, I've been so inspired by so many people in health service. I encounter so many lovely, wonderful people, you know, that... Of course, there are occasional people in health services who don't behave with compassion, but the vast majority are people who have made a commitment and have given up a large part of their lives to caring for their fellow human beings. And I just constantly encounter such people. And second, I've been able to see so many inspiring examples where organizations have changed their cultures, where teams have changed their cultures, and particularly the last 16 months. I mean, you know, let me give you two quick examples. Northumbria Healthcare, which happens to have the best levels of staff morale in the NHS and the lowest levels of staff stress, nevertheless under huge pressure, early in the pandemic when there was no, you know, there was inadequate PPE equipment, they pretty quickly made the decision as an organisation to build a factory and hire local sewers and cutters, and they made over 2.5 million gowns for use by their staff, but staff around the country. They created a community bank so that staff, you know, many staff, for example, their partners had lost their jobs. So rather than fall into the hands of these payday loan companies, they created a community bank where staff could get loans. And I could tell you 20, 30, 40 stories, if we have another few hours on the podcast, of similarly inspiring things happening across the country. Indeed, the pandemic was, you know, a time when so many people in so many places were demonstrating compassion. And that, I suppose, that seeing in practice where these things are happening is what's so inspiring and gives me a sense of hope. And so my message is one to everybody working in human service, public sector organisations, is that if we're to create the conditions where we have cultures that are characterised by compassion and healing, then it's really important that we encourage cultures that focus on delivering high quality, continually improving and compassionate support for staff, and that we encourage self-compassion amongst all, so that we create that sense of deep connection with ourselves that enables us to connect more deeply with others. And the last thing I would say is, you know, the more our public sector organisations create these kind of cultures, the more we transform society as a whole. It must be around 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 employed people work in the public sector. If they go into work every day and encounter compassionate cultures, they take that back out into their families and communities. If those who were served by public sector organisations encounter compassionate and inclusive cultures, they take that back out into their families and communities. So these institutions are the most important institutions in our society for bringing about long-term change. And that gives me enormous hope and optimism.
They're fantastic examples, actually, Michael. Thank you so much for sharing them. And thanks very much for coming on today. It's been a brilliant, brilliant opportunity to chat with you.
It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, Michael. And I'll tell you, one of the things I've loved is the way that you, because I've worked most of my life with people who are ready to give me an answer before I've asked the question. And I love the way in which you allow yourself a pause for thinking sometimes before answering. I think that's a real lesson to all of us. Thank you very much indeed.
It's been a privilege and a pleasure for me, David and Naomi. It's lovely to talk with you both. Thank you.
really nice conversation with Michael, and a number of things struck me. One was his thoughts on teams and team development, and particularly leadership, and his idea that leadership, or the best kind of leadership, was someone who was able to pay attention to the skills and the needs of every member of the team and to work hard in supporting and enhancing those skills that they all made as best a contribution as possible. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing that really struck me was his thought that in order to achieve anything, you had to be persistent. You had to come back to it again and again and again and again if necessary.
Yeah, I did. I thought that stood out as well. But I also, I suppose what I took from that is that also that if we want compassionate organisations, then there needs to be much more emphasis on focusing on building connection and relating, which reminded me of a conversation that's cropped up a few times for us on the podcast, that there can be a tendency to focus on specific treatments and interventions without recognising the value of the whole community within which those interventions are placed. And a colleague of mine recently said to me that in residential services, the whole of the residential service, so in somewhere like the TC, for instance, or the Fens, the whole of the residential service is like a cruise ship, but occasionally one of the lifeboats, which are the smaller interventions, breaks off and thinks it's actually the cruise ship because it's been carried along this big distance, when the value of the community is the thing that's ultimately the thing that's most important. And I think that really came across from Michael's conversation today, really emphasising the need to hone in on the community and make sure that people feel they belong. And that was really underlined by the references to how the more diverse a team is, the better the productivity, the happier people are, and actually those teams are much more innovative than the teams where everyone's the same. And that was a really nice takeaway from the conversation for me, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think people become very attached, committed to their role and the sort of creed that they identify with that role, be they psychiatrists or psychotherapists or psychologists, and then become, and sometimes with full justice, become prone to feeling that people are attacking their role and therefore them, and it becomes intensely personal. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.